All right, now we start a chapter that is called A Tour of the Cell. We are going to look at the important parts that you find in cells, most of which are organelles. But the opening slide here, before we get to that, is just an overview of where cells stand in the overall size of things in the natural world. It's important to understand that this is a logarithmic scale, just like pH is. So every step is really 10 times bigger than the step below it. This is an enormous range of sizes, down from the size of atoms all the way up to, well, it doesn't even include the biggest organisms because there are trees that are bigger than 10 meters, but that's a huge range. Only in this yellow range, though, are the vast majority of cells. There's all kinds of different cells, even within one organism like you, but especially when you consider all cells of all organisms. Despite that variety, though, there isn't all that much of a range in size of cells, and I'll explain why that's true in a little bit. Most of them are microscopic. There are some cells that you can see with the naked eye, but they're pretty rare, actually. And they're in a range that allows for seeing them via light microscopes, like we use today. To get the detail of the things that we're going to really study within the cells requires even more magnification, like for an electron microscope. Well, the second slide it is a look at a prokaryotic cell. Most of the time we're going to spend on eukaryotic cells, but most cells that are alive right now and most cells that have ever existed are prokaryotic, which could be either bacteria or archaea, as we already talked about. This one happens to be a bacterium, but the information is more or less the same. This is also kind of a catch-all picture because not every prokaryotic cell will have every one of these features. It just shows you some possibilities. Keep in mind, though, what makes it a prokaryotic cell. It does not have any membrane-bounded organelles, including a nucleus for which it's named, or the lack of which for which it's named. And that means prokaryotic cells are not compartmentalized. There is just one compartment in a prokaryotic cell, and all that stuff that's inside that cell is collectively called the cytoplasm. Any cell of any type, not just prokaryotic cells, but any cell has a plasma membrane that really defines the cell. It's the boundary between the cell and everything else in the universe. But a typical prokaryotic cell, in addition to its relatively thin plasma membrane that you see in cutaway here, will have a much thicker cell wall exterior to that, just like plant cells do. Our cells don't have that, though. And you might or might not have a capsule exterior to the cell wall, which is a layer of slimy material that allows it to stick to things, like your tonsils, for instance, and sort of these fimbriae, for that matter, which might be on some cells and might not be. You also see flagella at one end, another kind of optional feature. Not all cells have them. But flagella, which is a plural of flagellum, a flagellum is a whip-like structure that is a locomotory device. It propels the cell through the medium it lives in, liquid. Nucleoid, I talked about before when we were originally talking about the cell dichotomy. Be careful with that term because a nucleoid is not a nucleus. If this were a true nucleus, then this wouldn't be a prokaryotic cell by definition. Nucleoid simply means like a nucleus, and the reason it's like a nucleus is because that's where you find the DNA in a prokaryotic cell, just like you find DNA in a eukaryotic cell in the nucleus. But it's not a true nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane, and so the nucleoid is still part of the cytoplasm, the only compartment that's in that cell. Let's go to 3 now. And one of the most important parts of the cell, of course, is the plasma membrane. Like I said, it really defines the cell. That's how you know you're looking at a cell, because it's defined by the plasma membrane that contains everything inside. And the plasma membrane of any cell, even though the chemically they can differ, but any cell has a plasma membrane that is made out mostly of phospholipids that, as we've talked about, because of their amphipathic nature, will self-assemble in the presence of water into a phospholipid bilayer. A bilayer is two layers, and so each single layer is called a monolayer. A monolayer is one layer of phospholipids all arranged like humans next to each other. The other monolayer is similar, except that the two monolayers come together tail to tail. Now, what do I mean by the amphipathic nature of phospholipids? What does it mean for something to be amphipathic? Well, that's not what the word means. Amphipathic means having dual preferences or dual... we'll just say dual preferences. An amphipathic molecule is one that is polar at part of the molecule, and a different part of that same molecule is nonpolar. And this explains why the bilayer forms without any life, just spontaneously for reasons of polarity or nonpolarity in the presence of water. Phospholipids are similar to fats, but different in important respects. So let's think back to what we talked already about fats. A fat, or a triglyceride, or a triacylglycerol, is a four-part thing when you think about it in terms of building one. What are the four parts of a fat? You have a glycerol, which is what kind of molecule, as the name indicates? It's an alcohol, and it's actually a triple alcohol because it has three hydroxyls. And those hydroxyls are connection points where you can add other things to them. So a single glycerol, you can connect three things to. Well, in the case of a fat, all three of the things that you connect to that glycerol are fatty acids. And therefore, the overall fat, or triglyceride, is nonpolar because fatty acids, since they are mostly hydrocarbon, are nonpolar. Hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar because hydrocarbons are made up of carbon and hydrogen, and carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativity values, almost, so they equally share electrons. All right? And that's why fats, which are nonpolar, like to be around other nonpolar things, but they don't like to be around polar things, including water. That's why they're hydrophobic, in other words. Hydrophobic indicates nonpolar, and this is why oil, which is an example of fat, doesn't mix with water. You pour oil into water, the oil molecules individually are trying to get into the middle of the oil mass, away from the water. Of course, some of them have to be by the water at the edge, but it minimizes the number that are having to be exposed to the water that way. Well, a phospholipid is similar, but similar in that it uses, each individual phospholipid molecule uses a glycerol, which you can connect three things to, and that detail isn't shown in this cartoon, but we looked at it earlier. The difference, though, is that only two of those connection points are used to hook fatty acids to the phospholipid glycerols, phosphoacids glycerol. And that's why there are two tails here, not three. And then the third thing that you add, which is in the gray head of each one, is what? A phosphate group, which is why they're called phospholipids. Well, a phosphate group is a phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms, as we've learned, but the oxygen atom, one of the oxygen atoms in there, is beyond polar. It is ionized. dipolar means partially charged, right? Well, an ion is beyond that because it's fully charged. And so it's the phosphate head of a phospholipid that is the polar part of the overall amphipathic molecule. It's the tail, since they are mostly hydrocarbon, of the same molecule, the phospholipid, that is the hydrophobic part of the amphipathic molecule. And that's why they arrange the way they do. It's simply that the tails are trying to avoid being around water because it's polar and they are not. And the heads have no problem being around water, whether it's outside or inside. This is how the first cells started, because as phospholipids just were created by mechanisms we talked about in that experiment about early Earth, they accumulated in the ocean and then they just started forming cell-like bags. You can still make this happen simply by using a collection of phospholipids in pure water. No life. They'll form little cell-like structures. But those are not cells yet. That's how the cells originated, though. And the reason that they're not complete cells is because a phospholipid bilayer, purely phospholipid bilayer, cannot function as a plasma membrane for a living cell, because certain things will get through a phospholipid and certain other things won't. That's what we say is selectively permeable. Well, some of the things that can't easily get through a pure phospholipid bilayer happen to be things that cells have to get into or out of themselves in order to live. So a plasma membrane in a living cell can't be made of nothing but phospholipids. And that's why, as we see here, a true plasma membrane is not purely phospholipids, but it's phospholipid bilayer with other things embedded in there, including, most importantly probably, various kinds of proteins, which are what all these big purple things are. So these proteins are examples of membrane-bound proteins, because they are bound to or tied to the membrane. They're part of the membrane. They're not membrane-bounded. They are membrane-bound. And membrane-bound proteins do various jobs, but one of the important things that they do is allow certain things to go through the membrane, either into or out of the cell, that wouldn't be able to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, which is why cells can't have purely phospholipid bilayer membranes. All right, let's go to 4 now. A few minutes ago, I said that there isn't a huge range in size of cells, at least not in all three dimensions. What I mean by this is that, well, just to use an example, you all started out as one cell, a zygote. Now you're much bigger, but none of you just grew that one zygote cell to be an adult human-sized cell, because that's not possible. It's not possible for a cell to grow indefinitely in all three dimensions, meaning getting wider, deeper, and taller all at once, because there's a size limit, a constraint put on cell size that we call the surface area to volume ratio. That's what this slide is trying to explain, using a simple cube to represent a cell. Some cells are kind of cubic, especially plant cells, but it's just easier to think about the math if you think about it as a cube. And notice there aren't any units given here, because the units don't matter to what's being explained here. But let's consider this unicellular organism, this single cube, which is one by one by one. Okay, the surface area to volume ratio, like any ratio, is a fraction. It's one number divided by another. In this case, it's the surface area divided by the volume. Well, if you think about a cube, the surface area consists of 6 identical faces, right? And what is the surface area of one of those faces? Well, it's just 1 times 1, right? Length times width of the square. But there are 6 of them. So it's 6 times 1 by 1 for a total area of 6 square units, whatever units you're using, like square micrometers or whatever. Okay, that would be the surface area. The volume is 1 times 1 times 1, right? Cubic units. So you can see here that the volume is one cubic unit, whatever unit you use. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is 6 divided by 1, or 6. All right, now let's grow that one cell in all three dimensions at once. We're going to make it 5 times as big, 5 times as wide, 5 times as tall, 5 times as deep. It's a much bigger organism, but it's still one cell. Well, now each face of the cube is 5 by 5. So each face is 25 square units, but there's still 6 of them. So 6 times 25 is 150 square units of surface area. The volume is now 5 times 5 times 5, or 125 cubic units of volume. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is 150 divided by 125, 1.2. Notice what happened. As the cell grows in all three dimensions, both the surface area grows and the volume grows, but the surface area to volume ratio goes down. And that's easy to understand mathematically. Area, which surface area is an example of, is a second order function, right? If you look at y equals x squared, it's a parabola. We don't care about the negative part because negative size doesn't make sense for a cell. But y equals x cubed, which looks like this, once again, we don't care about the negative parts. They both, from above zero, grow. As x grows, y grows. But x cubed, which is this line, grows a lot faster than x squared does. So when a cell grows in all three dimensions, its volume gets bigger faster than its area gets bigger. Now, the reason this is so important to biology and the reason why it constrains cell size is that for any cell to remain alive, it has to be able to exchange materials and energy with its surroundings. It has to take certain things in. It has to get rid of certain things. Where does that exchange take place? Yes, at the surface, at the interface or the boundary between the cell and everything else. It's where the exchange has to take place. And so what that means is if a cell gets big in all three dimensions, eventually its interior, its volume, will be so big that the amount of stuff that needs to come in and out of it overwhelms the ability of the surface area to be enough surface area to get that stuff through. Because the surface area to volume ratio is going down. Now, there's ways around that. It's only a limit if the cell is growing in all three dimensions at once. But consider your own body. There are exceptional cells in one or two dimensions, but not three. Exceptionally large, I should say. For instance, there's a single neuron, one cell, that goes all the way from your toe to the base of your spinal cord. That's enormously long, right, for something that's supposed to be invisibly small. But notice that it's still invisibly small in the other two dimensions. So it doesn't have a big volume, even though it has a very long length, because you take that long length and then multiply it by tiny numbers twice, and that's still a small volume. It still has a lot of surface area compared to its volume. And similarly, if you think about it in terms of cooking, you know, if you want fried potatoes, you don't just throw a whole potato into the fryer. I mean, you can, but the reason that you like fried potatoes is because you like the browning, right? So you cut it into slices that don't have much volume for their surface area, and that's a lot more surface area to be able to brown, similarly with cells. So it's not that organisms can't get big, because we are proof of that. We are enormous organisms compared to the vast majority of organisms in the world. But the reason that we're able to get big is not by growing our cell, but by making our bodies out of many cells that are small, each of which then still has a large surface area to volume ratio. This is a multicellular organism just as big as this huge cube, but it's made out of many one by one by one cells, so the overall surface area to volume ratio is still 6, still high enough for there to be enough exchange of materials between each cell and its environment. All right, now to 5. And it's going to take a while to get through this slide, but then we'll speed up again after these. It takes a while because I want to describe each of these major parts that are listed here, and then we'll see close-ups of each one, and we can look at go through a lot faster then. This is an animal cell, though, and we'll look at a similarly looking one next slide that's a plant cell, but this one's an animal cell, and this is also a catch-all picture because not every animal cell is going to have every one of these features. Most of them will be in just about any animal cell, though. And I guess I'll work kind of clockwise, starting with the nucleus because it's pretty conspicuous. Now, animals, of course, are eukaryotes, so it shouldn't be surprising that there is a nucleus, but remember, that's not the only thing that defines a eukaryotic cell. It's what they're named for, the fact that they have a nucleus. But in addition to a nucleus, eukaryotic cells have other membrane-bounded organelles. A nucleus is an example, though, of a membrane-bounded organelle, an organelle or subcellular part that is surrounded by its own membrane. In that case of the nucleus, the membrane is called the nuclear envelope, and it's actually a special case. The nucleus is the first of 3 examples I'll give you of organelles that are not only membrane-bounded, but multiply membrane-bounded. And I don't know how much detail you can see, especially toward the back, but this nuclear envelope that I just mentioned is not a single membrane. There are 2 membranes layered together. And remember that each layer is already 2 layers, because when I say one membrane, that is a phospholipid bilayer made up of 2 monolayers. Here you have 2 bilayers, 2 layers of membrane, making up the overall nuclear envelope. And therefore, since it's a membrane-bounded organelle, that defines a separate compartment within the cell. In general, because eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles, those cells are compartmentalized, unlike prokaryotic cells. There is a cytoplasm, but it's not everything that's in the eukaryotic cell. The cytoplasm is collectively the stuff that's inside the cell, but outside of all of the membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus. So there is a separate compartment inside the nucleus that's different from everything outside of it, and it gets its own name. That all of the stuff inside the nucleus is not cytoplasm, it's nucleoplasm. And as you can see, there is a component of the nucleoplasm called chromatin, stuff that we'll spend a lot of time later talking about, but I just want to tell you what chromatin is. Chromatin is actually a mixture, as far as molecules are concerned. It's a mixture of nucleic acid, DNA, and proteins. So you might have been wondering why there is no DNA labeled here in the nucleus, since you already know that that's where you find the DNA in a eukaryotic cell. Well, the DNA is part of chromatin. Also in the nucleus, notice there is nucleolus. Be careful with that term, because it's so very similar to the word nucleus. The nucleolus is inside the nucleus, and it is part of the DNA, but not all of the DNA. It involves the genes of the DNA that are involved in making RNA types other than messenger RNA. This will make sense later when we talk more about genes and RNA in general. But I've already mentioned to you that in the course of making a protein, DNA is used to make messenger RNA, which that's what transcription is. And then the messenger RNA is used to assemble a protein, that's translation. Well, mRNA is just one of many kinds of RNA. The other kinds of RNA are produced by other genes in the nucleolus. That's what that's all about.
The nucleus is The library that you mentioned before, you borrow this DNA?
All of the DNA is, but the non-nucleus part, where there's also DNA, that's where the protein coding genes are. The genes in the nucleus are genes that have nothing to do with building proteins. They're there to tell the cell how to build the other kinds of RNA.
So should the chromatin have DNA, protein, something else?
No, just DNA and proteins.
Okay.
Another thing you should see or notice about the nuclear envelope is that it is perforated. It's full of holes. Each of these little pink complexes of proteins are arranged kind of like the staves of a barrel so that it can be hollow. It forms a little tunnel. Those little tunnels are called nuclear pores. And that's important because, speaking of transcription, which produces mRNA, that mRNA needs to exit, after it's produced, it needs to exit the nucleus to go out and join up with a ribosome in order to assemble the polypeptide to make the protein. So the nuclear pores allow for exit of messenger RNA. Now, obviously these are color-coded. A true animal cell would be pretty colorless if you looked at it under a microscope, so the nuclei are not really purple. But the purple here shows you everything that is officially called the nucleus. I want you to notice, though, that here and there, actually it's only shown one place here, but it's more than one place. Here and there, the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope folds outward, and in this picture becomes blue. And that's because even though it's the same membrane, it is now part of a different organelle. All of this blue membrane is a different organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum. A reticulum in general is something that is highly interconnected. Okay, now the endoplasmic reticulum is a lot of membrane, and it looks like it's a bunch of different sacs, but it's really just the same membrane highly folded. And notice the phrase endoplasmic reticulum in all caps has this brace below it to show you that the overall organelle has two parts to it, the so-called smooth endoplasmic reticulum and the rough endoplasmic reticulum, that not only have different names and different appearances, but do different jobs. Well, the rough endoplasmic reticulum is all of this stuff that looks like flattened sacs. What makes it look rough under a light microscope, and why it was named that, is the presence of all these little brown dots. Those are not actually part of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Each tiny brown dot in this picture is its own organelle. Each one of those is a ribosome, which is an example of an organelle that is not membrane-bounded. It's really just a little molecular machine. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But these ribosomes happen to be associated with the endoplasmic reticulum's membrane at the moment. They won't be permanently, but they're there, and that's why, under a light microscope, the rough endoplasmic reticulum looks rough. Well, what is the job of ribosomes? I've already told you, I think, but we'll study it in detail in a different chapter. Just to summarize now, though, a ribosome's job is translation, which is the second part of protein synthesis. When you have to build a protein, you start out with the instructions that are in DNA. That's in the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell. Those instructions are used to tell the cell how to build a different nucleic acid, messenger RNA, handing that code off, in a sense. That's what transcription is. And DNA's job is done at that point. That's when the mRNA, messenger RNA, has to be able to get out of the nucleus. That's why those pores are there. The messenger RNA then meets up with a ribosome and then the process of translation takes place, which is a situation in which the ribosome reads the code in the messenger RNA molecule, and that code tells the ribosome the specific order of amino acids to add one by one to make a polypeptide. That's how a protein is built. Okay, that in general is the job of ribosomes. These ribosomes happen to be associated with the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and that's why it looks rough. Now, finally, to the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. The function of rough ER is to modify newly made polypeptides. And that's why these ribosomes, which are building these brand new polypeptides, are associated with the membrane, so that the string of beads, so to speak, the new polypeptide, can be strung into the lumen, or hollow interior, that's a general word, the lumen of the rough ER, so that the rough ER can then take that brand new polypeptide and modify it appropriately so that it can do its job. Now, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is part of the same overall organelle. It's part of the same membrane, but notice that it doesn't look like flattened sac so much as a system of tubes made out of membrane. And it is not rough. It's smooth in appearance under a scope because it does not have these ribosomes associated with it, which makes sense because the smooth endoplasmic reticulum's job has nothing to do with modifying proteins. There are various jobs that the smooth ER performs, but one really important one for animals is to produce lipids, including cholesterol. Cholesterol, as we've already talked about, is a lipid that animals make and can't live without for various reasons. Lipids in general, though, get produced in smooth ER. And just to give another example, smooth ER is a place where certain ions are sequestered, like in your skeletal muscles. There's a bunch of calcium ions that are temporarily stored in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and as part of the process that allows muscles to contract, those calcium ions get released in a burst into the main cytoplasm, and that ends up causing contraction of muscles. We won't get into that detail right now, but that's another example.
Is the polypeptide being carried by the ribosome?
Yes, because the ribosome is making the polypeptide. It's the factory, it's the assembly line, and it just gets longer and longer. Well, since these ribosomes are associated with the membrane, as the polypeptide gets longer and longer, it gets strung into the inside of the ER so that the ER can then modify it, and it will be able to do its job. What the modification is just depends on the protein. All right, that's all the blue stuff. Now, if you didn't have this color coding in this figure, then you might mistake this cyan-colored one for just more endoplasmic reticulum, because it's also a system of folded membranes. But this is its own organelle, situated right next to the rough endoplasmic reticulum, but this cyan-colored one is called either the Golgi apparatus or the Golgi complex, or maybe even just the Golgi. Some books use different terminology. They're all named after the same dead Italian anatomist. Now, the job of the Golgi apparatus is quite different. As I just said, the rough ER, which looks very similar to it, has the job of modifying a new polypeptide. Once that's complete, once it modifies it, then the rough endoplasmic reticulum needs to package that polypeptide, or several copies of it, into a little bag made out of membrane that we call a vesicle. Vesicle is a general word that refers to any bag-like structure made out of membrane. And by membrane material, I'm talking about phospholipid bilayer chiefly, the same stuff that the plasma membrane is made out of. Membrane material moves around from organelle to organelle, including the plasma membrane. And this is one example of that. So the newly modified proteins that the rough ER has just modified get packaged into a little bag made out of a piece of the membrane that used to be part of the rough ER. In other words, a vesicle buds off of the ER. And that vesicle then travels to this cyan-colored Golgi complex. And it's made out of membrane too, the same stuff pretty much. So when a vesicle made out of membrane meets up with the Golgi's membrane, they will fuse together, kind of like coalescing of oil droplets in a sense. And that will spill this cargo of newly modified proteins into the lumen of the Golgi so that the Golgi can do its job. And the job of that Golgi complex is to figure out where these now modified proteins go in order to do their job. Some of them are going to be exported all the way out of the cell, for instance. Some of them might be embedded into the plasma membrane. The Golgi complex figures that out and sends them on their way appropriately. So the Golgi complex, by analogy with a factory, for instance, is more or less a receiving and shipping center. It receives vesicles of newly modified proteins from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then it packages them again. Kind of, it opens up the package, figures out where they need to go, puts them in a new vesicle made out of Golgi membrane, and then sends those vesicles to the appropriate place. That's the shipping part of the job. All right, that brings us to the bottom of the figure if we're working clockwise. And you have a lysosome here. A lysosome is a vesicle, really, but this vesicle happens to be a specialized organelle. So we don't call it just a vesicle, we call it a lysosome. But the "some" part of that word means body, like the word somatic means of the body. And you already know what lyse means, right? Like in hydrolysis or lysis, it means splitting. So this means splitting body. So named because the job of a lysosome is to break big molecules down into smaller pieces. In other words, to digest them chemically. Well, what kind of chemical reaction must be taking place then in lysosomes? Hydrolysis, exactly. As we'll talk more and more about, just about every reaction that's occurring in a cell as part of its metabolism is helped along by enzymes. In other words, just about all chemical reactions, biochemical reactions, are catalyzed reactions, catalyzed by their own enzyme, including hydrolysis reactions occurring in a lysosome. And we therefore call those kinds of enzymes hydrolytic enzymes, because they're enzymes for the purposes of hydrolysis, to break big things into smaller. Hydrolytic, you mean? It's just the adjective form of hydrolysis, spelled thus. Now, hydrolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around, because they cause hydrolysis, breaking big things into small. Well, you don't want to break everything apart, right? So you don't want to have hydrolytic enzymes around the parts of the cell that you don't want to tear down. And that's why they are put into their own little membrane-bounded sac called a lysosome, so that hydrolysis can occur inside safely away from all the rest of the stuff that you want to protect. Next up is a mitochondrion. And what's shown here is the singular. It's pointing to just one mitochondrion, but mitochondria is the plural. And typically, a cell that has mitochondria will have several. Not necessarily the three that you see here, but anyway, each of these is a mitochondrion. And the mitochondrion is the second of the three examples that I'm giving you of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus was the first one. A mitochondrion also has multiple membranes. There is an outer membrane. I mean, that's the name of it, self-descriptive. And there is an inner membrane. And you can even, without looking at it in close-up, you can probably see from there that the outer membrane is actually smaller than the inner membrane, because the outer membrane is just a smooth membrane, only as big as it needs to be to cover the whole thing. The inner membrane, though, is made up of a lot more material because there's a lot of different folds in it. Now, why would you have folds in a membrane? To increase surface area, exactly. And that makes sense given what the job of a mitochondrion is. We'll study it in detail in Unit 3, but the overall job, the most important job of a mitochondrion, is a complex set of biochemical reactions collectively called cellular respiration. And I'm not going to give you the details of this, but let me just tell you that cellular respiration is a way for cells to maximize the efficiency of their fuels, by which I mean burn their fuels as completely as possible so they can extract as much energy as possible from those fuels and therefore end up storing as much of that energy as possible in the form of ATP molecules. But we won't get into the details of that until after this upcoming test. That'll be part of Unit 3. Okay, now, peroxisomes are shown here, and to look at them, you wouldn't be able to tell apart a peroxisome from a lysosome. And that's for good reason. They really do very similar jobs, but their jobs aren't identical. They have different names because of that. Peroxisomes are named for the fact that they take care inside of them of the problem of dealing with various so-called reactive oxygen species, or just ROS for short, including peroxides. That's why where you get the name peroxisome. As part of normal metabolism, there are various byproducts that get formed that are oxidizing agents. Those are the so-called reactive oxygen species. Remember, we talked about oxidizing agents. An oxidizing agent is something that can oxidize something else, right? Which means rob it of electrons. Well, you don't always want that to happen because that can damage things. This is why we have in the anti-aging nutrition news, it's why it's such a big deal to talk about antioxidants. Antioxidants are things that help reduce the effects of these reactive oxygen species. But we also have built-in organelles to do that job, which are the peroxisomes. Okay, now next, let's go up to the all caps word here, cytoskeleton. Cyte or cyto means cell, whenever you see that in a word. That's why the individual names of so many kinds of cells end in cyte, like myocyte, a muscle cell, or neurolemmocyte, which is a kind of nerve cell, and so on. But a cytoskeleton is a collection of different proteins, actually three major categories of proteins, which is why this was put into all caps and a colon, to show you that the three major categories of proteins that collectively make up the cytoskeleton are microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. They're all structure. Well, yes, they're all fibrous proteins because they're all very long compared to their width. And we'll compare them in a different slide when we can look at them individually. But you see a bunch of microtubules in yellow here. And the reason I'm mentioning those ones right now, which is just one of the three major kinds of proteins found in the cytoskeleton, is to explain another organelle. Before we get to that, though, the cytoskeleton is named this because it's kind of like our endoskeleton. The bones that make up our skeleton give us support and structure. And that's part of the job of the cytoskeleton. But it's also, because of these microtubules, it's also a job of the cytoskeleton to act as a system of roads along which things can be moved from one place in the cell to another, just like trucks take things down highways from one place to another in the state.
Well, this means that, like how you were saying at the beginning, you're forming proteins, so that could like the transport from the prokaryotes.
Yes. Yes, a vesicle of just about anything, including proteins, can be moved along these microtubules as roads to go from one place in the cell to another. But notice that these microtubules, these yellow strands, are all emanating from this kind of diffuse yellow halo. I'm not talking about the T shape here. I'm talking about the yellowness around it. That yellowness is an organelle called the centrosome. All right? And the centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. So these microtubules, being proteins, are polymers. They're built little by little, and they grow as they're being built out from the centrosome. As we'll see when we go to plants, plants and other kinds of eukaryotic cells also have centrosomes. What's different about animal cells, though, is that in an animal centrosome, you find these other proteins arranged, they look like two pieces of licorice, arranged in a T, and those are called centrioles. So be careful with the terminology. Centrioles in animal cells are found in the centrosome. And I wish I could tell you what the centrioles do, but we haven't figured it out yet.
Are there any ideas?
Well, as we'll study later, the centrosomes are important in cell division. Mitosis and meiosis are parts of cell division. And that requires the centrosomes and the microtubules that grow from them. So it's kind of reasonable to think that since the centrioles are in the centrosome, that they must have something to do with that as well. But there's a couple problems with that. Non-animal eukaryotic cells, like plant cells, also have centrosomes for the same reason, and they undergo mitosis and meiosis without any centrioles. So that is a problem for one thing. But also, you can actually experimentally remove the centrioles from animal cells, and it doesn't seem to have any effect. They still do the stuff that they're able to do. So they must be there for some reason, otherwise the cell wouldn't build them. But there's a lot of things we don't know about yet. Anyway, that's one way you can tell that this is an animal cell, because it has centrioles in its centrosome. It also, though, doesn't have a cell wall. It has only a plasma membrane. All right. You also have a flagellum on this particular cell. Remember I said it's a catch-all. Not every animal cell is going to have a flagellum. In fact, most don't. But what's a good example of a flagellated animal cell? Right, a human sperm or sperm in general for animals are flagellated. And just like I was talking about for prokaryotes that are flagellated, a flagellum, if it is present, is there for the purpose of locomotion. A sperm has a long distance in terms of its body length. It has to swim a long distance to get to a egg, if it has any hope of fertilizing that egg and turning it into a zygote. All right, that's the whole long slide. Let's go to 6 now and look at a similar one for plants. A plant cell is so similar to an animal cell because they are fellow eukaryotes, of course. And so this isn't going to take as long to go through, because a plant cell will have just about everything that an animal cell will have, except it doesn't have centrioles. And I'm not going to repeat those things again, because they have the same function in a plant cell as they do in an animal cell. What I want to focus on the plant cell slide is the things that you find in plant cells but that you don't find in animal cells. And one of these things I've already talked about a couple times already, which is the cell wall that occurs outside of the plasma membrane. Of course, a plant cell has its own plasma membrane. Every cell has to have one. That's what defines the cell. but it's pretty flimsy compared to the much thicker brown cell wall, which is made out of, in the case of plants, mostly cellulose, polysaccharide, giving it its toughness. And so cell walls are found between cells. This is just one cell shown, but you can see that there will be another cell here, and so on. Cell wall between them. So that's one thing. But while we're talking about cell walls, notice that there are things called plasmodesmata. That's a plural word. The singular is simply plasmodesma, without the TA at the end. Each plasmodesma is a little tunnel through the thickness of the cell wall between two cells. So that means a plasmodesma is an example of an intercellular junction, a joining place between two cells, is what intercellular junction literally means. And if you look at the cutaway view of one of these plasmodesma, one of these plasmodesmata, this one, you can see that it's not just a tunnel through plasma through cell wall material. That tunnel is lined by plasma membrane material. This yellowness is the plasma membrane of this cell, which continues through the walls, through the inner wall of the plasmodesma, and then it will be continuous with the plasma membrane of the next cell. And what this means is that even though we call all the cells of a plant individual cells, they really share one big cytoplasm that extends through all these plasmodesmata between the cells. And plasmodesmata, since they are little tunnels, function for intercellular communication. Certain things can get through those plasmodesmata, and those things that can get through can cause things to happen in other cells. For instance, just like animals, plants have hormones, and hormones can travel through plasmodesmata, for instance. Yeah.
The cell walls are kind of
like
a lattice work?
Yeah, they are there just like the structural wall of a building, as I was saying before, with the flimsy paint being the plasma membrane. And what I was saying about the plasma membrane here is that if the plasmodesmata were just a hole in the cell wall, it would be brown on the interior. But it's lined by membrane. The cell wall itself is not membrane, though. It's, like I said, it's mostly cellulose. And that cellulose, of course, is built inside cells and exported out as it's built. Organisms can't build proteins and other structures like that outside of cells. It has to be built inside and then exported. Okay, now, that's one of the major differences. Of course, you also have this huge-looking thing that appears empty. And the fact that it appears empty, even though it's not, is why it got the name, really a misnomer, central vacuole. Vacuole means vacuous or empty, but it's not truly empty. A central vacuole is really just a big version of a vesicle. It's still made out of membrane material. It's just much bigger than the average vesicle. And the reason it's not empty is that it contains at least water. It just looks empty compared to other things around it under a microscope because, unlike animal cells, plant cells have color to them that allow them to photosynthesize. They look green. But the central vacuole doesn't. So anyway, that's why it was named that. And the central vacuole can be used for various things, including more or less as a trash dump. A plant cell is able to put things into the central vacuole that it wants to get away from the rest of the cytoplasm, but more or less get rid of it. But also, that's where you can find pigment molecules sometimes, like the pinkness of a red onion. If you didn't look at it today, you will next week. That's not spread all the way through the cytoplasm, so it's not the whole cell is that pink color. The pinkness, the pigment molecules themselves, are in the central vacuole of the cell. Another thing to say about the central vacuole is that since it is mostly water, and since it occupies a huge fraction of the overall volume of the cell, and since Plants don't have to make water. They just have to get it from the soil. This is one reason why, compared to animals, plants can grow a lot quicker, usually. And if you think of a brand new seedling, just overnight, they can get noticeably bigger. That's a lot of cells being added. But you don't have to build the stuff that's making up a lot of that volume, because it's just water filling up a central vacuole. Okay, now, the other thing that we haven't talked about that is here, because animal cells don't have them, are these conspicuous green organelles, which are chloroplasts. And this is the third of the three examples of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. So you have the nuclear envelope, or I mean you have the nucleus is multiply membrane-bounded, the mitochondrion is, and so is the chloroplast. The chloroplast is something we'll study in detail, just like the mitochondrion, in a different chapter. But overall, the job, the major job of the chloroplast is another complex set of reactions called photosynthesis. And photosynthesis has the important job of producing organic molecules out of inorganic molecules. In general, we call that process carbon fixation. And so, let me just quickly say that ecologically speaking, there are two major kinds of organisms in the world. There are producers and there are consumers. The producers of the world, which includes plants, but there's other producers as well, but the producers of the world are able to fix carbon. That meaning they're able to make organic compounds out of inorganic material. No consumer, by definition, is able to do that. But every consumer absolutely requires organic materials, which is why every consumer vitally requires producers to live. And that's why it's bad for many reasons what we're doing to rainforests. But one of the worst things is that we're killing ourselves because we're getting rid of producers, and we are consumers that rely on those producers. So anyway, there's photosynthesis that occurs there. We'll look at the details of that in its own chapter in Unit 3. But you can see here that there are multiple membranes, just like mitochondrion and nucleus. And therefore, just like... I haven't talked about that yet, so I will in a minute. Anything else that I didn't talk about? No, I don't think so. No, that's a quick rundown, or not so quick, but it's a rundown. Now we can get to the part of the show where we can get through slides a little quicker, because they're just really close-ups of what we've already talked about. Slide 7 shows you two organelles in one, the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum. And that makes sense because of what I've already told you, namely that they're connected. It's one membrane of the nuclear envelope continuous with the membrane that makes up the endoplasmic reticulum. You can see that in better detail here. You also get a nicer view of the nuclear pores, each of which is a complex of proteins arranged to form a little tunnel. That's where the messenger RNA can get out. It's produced in the nucleus. It needs to get out and go find a ribosome to actually produce the protein, which is what its instructions are for. And that's why you can see a ribosome here. Speaking of ribosomes, well, we'll see a better view of ribosomes in a minute. Oh yeah, chaperonins are proteins, so they're like other proteins inside the cell. They're just specialized for the function of helping other proteins fold up into shape. They're part. They're in the cytoplasm, though.
It's the. Just to make sure, the outer nuclear.
The outer layer of the nuclear envelope?
Yeah, that's the one that connects to the ER.
That's right. That's what you're seeing right here, even though it's more than just one place this happens. It's the inner one is staying as part of the nucleus. This outer one is folding out here and there. And that's why the book is changing the color from purple to blue to show you that officially now that membrane is part of a different organelle. All right, let's go to 8. Speaking of ribosomes, we see a single ribosome here, much bigger, so we can see some detail. And one thing that you see you didn't see before when they were just little dots is that a single ribosome is made up of two subunits that come together. And these are very descriptively called the large subunit and the small subunit. I don't think I have to go on as to why. But this is a lie, I should tell you. By which I mean, and not only because it's a cartoon, but it's a lie because a ribosome's two subunits aren't actually ever together with nothing else around, like they are here. The two subunits only come together after a messenger RNA molecule has already bound, and we'll get into that detail later. But it's just showing you that a complete ribosome is made up of by two subunits. Now, the subunits, all of the small subunits are identical. All of the large subunits are identical within a cell, and therefore they are modular. So it's not that there is any close relationship between this particular large subunit and this particular small subunit. It will be disassembled, and then when a ribosome needs to be made again, it's not necessarily going to be these two that get together. Any large subunit and any small subunit can get together to form the overall ribosome. Another thing that I haven't mentioned yet here is the difference between this terminology. Free ribosomes and bound ribosomes are shown here, even though they are really the same thing. In fact, they are just the same thing in different times. Here's what I mean. I already told you that the job of a ribosome is translation, which is when a polypeptide gets assembled one amino acid at a time. That happens on a ribosome. And that process of translation always starts on a ribosome that's not attached to any membrane, a ribosome that we call a free ribosome. Okay, so all proteins get started being built on a free ribosome. Some of them start and end on a free ribosome. The whole process of making the polypeptide for certain proteins occurs on a ribosome that's not attached to anything. And those are proteins that are going to be able to fold up into three-dimensional shape and operate without any modification. All right? Some proteins, though, depending on the protein, are not going to be able to do that. They need to be modified after being built before they can do their job. And I already told you that that is the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, to modify newly made polypeptides. So some polypeptides will start out being built on a free ribosome. They'll stay on that ribosome, but as soon as the cell figures out this is going to be one of those proteins that need to be modified, the whole complex, the ribosome and the emerging polypeptide, will be moved over to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and that's why the rough endoplasmic reticulum looks rough. It has a bunch of ribosomes on it that are making the rest of the protein, stringing it into the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum so that they can be modified by the ER. All right? And when I first described the endoplasmic reticulum, I said that these ribosomes are not part of the endoplasmic reticulum. They're their own organelles, and they're there only for the moment, because when the job of producing the polypeptide that's getting put into the ER is done, the ribosomes are going to detach from the membrane. It's always a new set of ribosomes that are currently attached to the rough ER's membrane.
There's a large unit and a small subunit.
That's right.
Can there be also a small subunit on top and another small subunit on bottom?
No, it's not two of the same type that come together. It's always one large and one small. But it can be any large, because all the larges are the same, and any small, because they're all the same as each other. Okay, now to 9. Here we have a look at the ER again, but in this, but the purpose of this, though, is to show you what I've described in words, namely the formation of a vesicle budding off from the rough ER. So this is how the rough ER packages its export material, which is a collection of these newly modified polypeptides. It does so by just pinching off a little bit of its own membrane, the ER's membrane, and that's why this vesicle is shown in the same blue, to show you that that came from this membrane part. This is how membrane moves around from organelle to organelle. And the destination of this vesicle with newly modified proteins in it is going to be the nearby organelle we already talked about, the one that was cyan-colored, which is the Golgi complex, just not shown in this picture. It is shown in 10, though. And so I told you that the Golgi complex, it operates more or less as a receiving and shipping center. Those are two different jobs that in a factory that has a shipping and receiving, or has shipping and receiving centers, those are at different parts of the factory, right? Trucks delivering things go to receiving. Usually on the other side of the building, other kinds of trucks are picking things up to take them away. That's shipping. Similarly, the Golgi complex has two faces that do different jobs. This is another example of polarity. Nothing to do with charge. Just means there are two different ends to something. In this case, two different ends to the Golgi complex. The receiving end and the shipping end. And they are named differently. Notice that we use the same words as we did for geometric isomers back in that chapter. There's the cis face and the trans face. Cis means same side, trans means across or other side. So the cis face, which is the face that is up against the endoplasmic reticulum, is the receiving center. Makes sense because it's receiving vesicles from the endoplasmic reticulum, like this blue vesicle. That's why it's blue, to show you it came from the ER. But since it's made out of membrane material, it will easily fuse with the membrane making up the Golgi complex and dump its contents, newly modified proteins, into the lumen of the Golgi. It, meaning the Golgi complex, will figure out where they need to go and package them in a brand new vesicle made out of Golgi material. And that's why this output is now a cyan-colored vesicle. And that vesicle is going to go to wherever these proteins need to go, including maybe the plasma membrane. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was thinking, I can see how the Golgi membrane kind of stays like consistent, but how does the ER membrane, like...
How does it get replenished?
Yes.
Because in addition, it's not a one-way travel of membrane material. This is a good question. There's also... You know, these vesicles that are coming from the Golgi, a lot of those are going to be put into the plasma membrane. And that's going to make the plasma membrane bigger if that's all that were happening. But the cell is continuously taking stuff from the plasma membrane also. And a lot of that membrane material gets put back into the endoplasmic reticulum. So membrane material is moving around all the time. At any given moment, it could be part of a lot of different organelles. Yeah, that was a good question. Okay. So that's the Golgi. Let's look at 11. And this kind of goes along with what I was just saying, movement around of membrane material. But we have on the bottom an example of one of the three categories of transport processes that I talked about in the lab, transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. Do you remember the three categories?
I have
active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. Well, vesicular transport just means transport involving a vesicle. Vesicular is the adjective of vesicle. Well, that's a big group of processes. Vesicular transport, by definition, involves a vesicle, but there's multiple ways that can happen. For instance, you can use a vesicle to move something into the cell or move something out of the cell. And therefore, there are two major subdivisions of vesicular transport, named for the direction of travel of the stuff being transported. One of those is endocytosis. Another use of site meaning cell. Osis means condition, site means cell, endo means within. So endocytosis is vesicular transport to bring something into the cell. But there's also exocytosis, the other major category. Much the same process, it's just in the reverse. You're using a vesicle to move something out of the cell. Okay, well then, all endocytosis is inward movement. But you can subdivide that again, depending on what the nature is of the stuff being taken in. One of those subdivisions of endocytosis is shown here in A, phagocytosis. The phago that you see in several words, like esophagus, has that same root, means eat. And so phagocytosis is a word that means cell eating, just by analogy with how we eat things. What we eat as opposed to drink is mostly solid stuff. Well, if you use a vesicle via endocytosis to bring in a solid piece from the environment, that is cell eating or phagocytosis. You can do the same thing that's pictured here, though, you just have to imagine it, by taking a little sip of the liquid exterior instead. And that would be called pinocytosis. P-I-N-O means drink. So there's cell eating and cell drinking, pinocytosis and phagocytosis, both subdivisions of endocytosis. Yeah, the pinocytosis is just this. And it is just one part of endocytosis. Phagocytosis is the other part. Look what's happening here in phagocytosis, by the way. This chunk is taken in as some sort of nutrient, food in other words, and this is what I was talking about in lab as calling vesicular transport a cheating mechanism, because it's a way of getting something into or out of the cell without that thing actually passing through a membrane. Right? The plasma membrane surrounds the thing and then seals off to form a vesicle. Now it's inside the cell, but it never went through a membrane. But this is going to be used as nutrition in this case. That's why it's called a food vacuole. So to use that as fuel, the cell has to break it apart. In other words, hydrolyze it. So you have a lysosome with this dangerous digestive enzymes I was talking about. Well, it can be fused with the food vacuole because they're both made out of membrane. And now you have the enzymes exposed to the thing you want to break down, but still safely away from everything else. In B, you have a similar process, I mean, as far as breaking it down using the enzymes. But this is called autophagy. Still means eating, the P-H-A-G part. But auto means self. So it's self-eating rather than some external thing being used, it's autophagizing. And this is done for the purpose of recycling worn out materials, more or less. In this case, a mitochondrion here is worn out. It's seen better days. Go ahead.
So that's part of exocytosis?
No, exocytosis isn't shown here.
Okay.
But we'll look at it in a different slide eventually. This doesn't involve bringing anything in. This mitochondrion was there to begin with, but it's no longer working. And so it's not going to do the job of cellular respiration anymore, but it's not something you want to just trash. Just like you don't want to throw away a car that doesn't work anymore, right? There's cars are highly recycled. They use all the various parts for it for various reasons. And this is made out of valuable molecules that can be reassembled into something new if you break it apart. So that's why it's called autophagy. You're breaking down a part of yourself. It just happens to be in the picture, but the peroxisomes are there because mitochondria are examples of structures that make a fair amount of these reactive oxygen species, which peroxisomes are there to deal with. They kind of go hand in hand, in other words. Okay, 12. Actually, no new information here. It's just showing you just how much volume the central vacuole can take up. And if you don't believe the cartoon, you can look at an actual photomicrograph, which is what this is. And this is a huge chunk of the volume, which is why plants can seemingly grow so quickly. 13. Oh, am I over? You should have stopped me. Okay, I'll stop there.